This program is made possible thanks to the generosity of our listeners. Show your support at heritageradionetwork.org/donate.
This week on Meat and Three, we're talking about comfort food as we explore its history, meaning, and different interpretations from around the world.
Donburi is just a simple, casual dish, but it's packed with the history.
Somebody might have their comfort food be something that they remember eating at their friend's house, but they would never have at their own home. Consuming foods that were eaten then can bring back some of those feelings from those times.
It's about creating these little breaks and moments during the day where you kind of feel present.
Tune in to Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup, wherever you listen to podcasts.
This is Meant to be Eaten on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Krishnendu Ray, standing in for Coral Lee. My guest today is Kyungjin Bae. Kyungjin is a James P. Storer Assistant Professor of Asian History at Kenyon College, and she's a historian of early modern China with interest in material culture, the history of technology, and cross-cultural studies. And this episode is part of a Gastronomica roundtable on taste and technology in East Asia that explores the production and consumption of soy sauce in Korea from the 18th to the early 20th centuries. Welcome, Kyungjin.
Hi, Krishnendu. It's an honor to be here. I'm very excited about our conversation today.
It's lovely to have you. And I just read your piece. It's a really stimulating piece. So let's just dive in.
Sure.
So let me begin with the kind of broadest question, which is how long does it take to get from, say, soybean to soy sauce in Korean history? And what kind of evidence survives about it?
That's an interesting question. So a lot of the studies about history of soy sauce making or soy fermentation, it's kind of a retrospective. So a lot of the evidences are actually present in our contemporary experiences. And a lot of scholars kind of trace the history of those practices back to the earlier time periods. So there are a number of sources through which you could look at that. Some of them are kind of recipe books or agricultural treaties where scholars discuss about like different agricultural practices throughout year. There are also, I'm sure that we're going to talk about it later, but cookbooks where scholars, especially women, talk about, you know, how to process beans and, you know, how to brew them into different kinds of fermented sauces. So in terms of the timeline, it takes about roughly 4 to 6 months for soybeans to become soy sauce. It's apparently a long period of time, and it varies across different periods in different places and different latitudes, obviously. So soybeans are harvested around like late fall, and then they're first made into what we call meju, which is a sort of boiled and mashed and lumped soybean pastes, which are fermented over the course of a month or two by, you know, the well-known fungi or mold koji. And after that's done, the next step is to brew them into the soy sauce.
I was thinking, when is it first time in the historical record that you begin to see soy sauce?
The historical record of soy sauce actually goes back to probably earlier Joseon period, which is starting from the end of the 14th century, or even before. But it's kind of hard to define what exactly is soy sauce at that time period, because a lot of different kind of sauces are lumped together into the same word. And there are different recipes and different formulas for them. So the exact kind of soy sauce that we are consuming nowadays wasn't really sort of the the mainstream soy sauce at that time period. That comes much later.
I see. And what is the word under which soy sauce is one of the sauces?
Oh, yeah. Taken together, those all kind of fermented soy sauces are called chang, okay, or chang yu. The word denoting soy sauce is called ganjang, but that's more of a contemporary word. Historically, that's been called cheongjang, which is kind of a purified or clear sauce, or gamjang, sweet sauce. There are different words for it.
I see. And you, in the article, you talk about a big transformation in the 18th century. And I think you gestured towards it on the Meju base, kind of a double fermentation. Mm-hmm. So could you tell our listeners a little bit detail about the context in which this new product is emerging?
Yeah, sure. So as I mentioned, there were various kinds of fermented soy sauces prior to the 18th century, simply because Korea is one of the natural habitat for soy crops, and there were simply abundance of them. But the way in which this particular method based on fermented meju being sort of standard method has to do with a transforming relationship with the market and the government in Seoul. So in the 18th century, the government started to kind of procure these mejus directly from the townspeople in Seoul. Prior to that, they went through some kind of agency, the merchant agency called tribute merchants. Mm-hmm. But after the beginning in the early 18th century, they start to requisition directly from the townspeople. So a huge number of young, especially male kind of townspeople start to work for these meju guilds. I think the proper English word for it is guilds. And there were just a tremendous amount of meju being made every year. And some of them start to be channeled towards the urban markets. So with that transformation, meju as the basis of fermentation became more and more mainstream and eventually become standard, which nowadays people think as, you know, established tradition. But that's fairly late.
I see. So that's almost like what, an 18th century phenomena?
Yes.
I see. That what we call, what modern people come to call as traditional Korean soy sauce is a kind of an 18th century invention, a sort of.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay. Hey, just to change the topic up a little, I was wondering, you describe yourself as a historian of early modern China. Okay. Is there a particular reason why a historian of early modern China is working on Korean soy sauce?
Yes, that's a little bit of a story. So
tell us that story. Yes. Yeah.
I was a postdoctoral fellow at the University of Hong Kong's Hong Kong Institute of Institute for Humanities and Social Science in 2018 and 19. And as a postdoctoral fellow, I was part of this larger collaborative research team, which studied sort of East Asian food from the perspectives of history of technology. And there were Chinese soy sauce groups, and there were Japanese soy sauce groups, and there simply weren't one for Korea. And although I'm a Chinese historian, you know, I happened to be a Korean there, and I knew a little bit about the pre-modern Korean history. So I took the initiative and started researching about this in Korea. And I took my perspective or my expertise as a historian of technology and material culture in it. So it's very much about my taste, actually.
I see. Does the language kind of resources, is there a linguistic reason in some ways in terms of the sources? Because then my next question, maybe I'm going to ask that question and you're going to respond it, is elaborate a little more on these sources you referenced before, on agricultural treatises, household encyclopedias. And from your piece, I learned that a number of them were written by women. Could you talk a little to us about these sources that you used to eventually reconstruct the history of soy sauce in Korea?
Sure, yes. So there are definitely benefits for me as a Chinese historian to investigate this subject, because pre-modern Korean language was largely diglossic, meaning there were two dominant languages that governed a society. One was classical Chinese, the other was vernacular Korean. And classical Chinese was the language or a script dominated by male elite scholars. And the vernacular Korean was the language of women, especially educated elite women. So they wrote in these two literary genres or linguistic genres. And I was able to read both of them, luckily. The agricultural treatise is more of a sort of imbuing the ideology of the statecraft from the perspective of these bureaucrats. And they saw agriculture, soybean cultivation, and soy sauce making being part of them as an important evidence of the people's well-being and maintaining social, political, economic order. So that that's the reason that a lot of these male scholars issued agricultural treaties and famine relief manuals and things like that. For the woman's encyclopedia or woman's writing about soybeans or soy sauce, it's more about everyday household management that a lot of these elite women are considered as the mainstay of their lives. So they wrote about a particular kind of processes of fermentation, brewing, and cooking, and that kind of formed women's lineage book. I call them kind of female version of lineage book, because even though pre-modern Korea was patrilineal and patriarchal society, women took an important part of constructing, you know, the social order and gender roles, and these female cookbooks kind of were more like a woman's side of, you know, talking about their lineage and inheritance of their skills and tastes.
I see. And so compared to, say, in Western heritage of writing, and are they analogous to, in some ways, cookbooks, which are also kind of household manuals? Is that a good analogy?
Yes, yes, okay. Absolutely.
Excellent. Hey, and the women play a crucial role in the production, consumption, and in fact, tasting. And that's one of your big arguments, is that eventually that's going to change. But at this point of time, women are playing a crucial role in kind of judgments of taste. What is some of the conversation going on, say, in some of these household manuals? Are these women arguing it with each other manuals, or are they kind of standalone?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So a short answer for that is those household manuals or cookbooks are more of a standalone piece that was kept within the boundary of families or at-large clan members. They weren't really published, or they weren't really circulated in a way that one version competed with another, because it was constructed as I mentioned, sort of a lineage tradition where an established taste within a family has to be inherited and reproduced in the following generations. So that was a way in which women of a family or women of a clan sort of constructed this collective palette together.
Having said that,
yep. Uh-huh. Having said that, though, I think the society as a whole accepted the kind of non-standard heterogeneous tastes of soy sauce as kind of de facto or given, because there was no discussion of, you know, which soy sauce has to entail these kind of flavors or these kind of standards, or soy sauce has to be used in this or that way. There was really no discussion of that in public. It was mostly kind of kept within the bounds of families.
I see. And most of these household treatises, are they handwritten? And what's the relationship between writing and, say, the printing revolution? When does that get to Korea?
Yes. These are definitely handwritten manuscripts. And in fact, a lot of women who wrote these cookbooks did care a lot about how long this will last. So some of women authors kind of prefaced, you know, their cookbook by saying that, like, try to be nice to this copy so that it can't last long, and transcribe it, but don't try to be, you know, wild with the manuscript. It was only in the probably late 19th or early 20th centuries that these sort of transcribed and original manuscripts of this cookbook started to be published. During the most of the Joseon period, which is up to 1910, there weren't much of this publication of female cookbooks outside their, you know, bounds of clans. Having said that, though, there were certainly publishing and printing industry during the Joseon era, but they were more geared towards this male agricultural treaties or the kind of government documents or religious documents.
I see. And so, like, are there like huge number of these household? Could one make a guess how many of these household treatises and where are the big collections? Sorry, I'm maybe driving you down a rabbit hole of historiography.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, I'm not very confident that I can give a conclusive answer to that question, but that probably comes hand in hand with this establishment of these larger clans in the second half of the Joseon Dynasty, which is after 17th centuries. So initially, even the language, the local vernacular script was just written, used by the court ladies or, you know, the urban aristocratic families. And then they started to kind of spread over 2-3 centuries into these various rural areas, into these clan families. So that comes in, you know, they're kind of in tandem with the spreading of female cookbooks and collecting them within the house bounds in these different areas.
Excellent. Hey, so we're going to take a short break and we'll be back with Kyungjin in just a moment, and we will move to the next phase of the transformation of soy sauce in Korea.
All of us at HRN have been keeping busy, despite working and recording from home. This fall, we're proud to announce new shows on the network that each bring important and enlightening stories to listeners around the world. While the world is in turmoil and the future of our country is uncertain, there are certain constants that help keep us going. For us, food and storytelling are essential. While we can't come together in person, food podcasts from HRN provide a virtual table we can all gather around. Bringing exceptional stories to your ears and keeping you informed on the ever-changing political and environmental issues of our time is integral to our mission. At a time when the world around us is rapidly changing, HRN is committed to being here for our listening community, and we need you to be here for us. Join our table and help ensure the future of food radio by becoming a member of HRN. Go to heritageradionetwork.org/donate to make a contribution. Check out the latest additions to our lineup while you're there. You can see all of our series at heritageradionetwork.org/new show.
Okay, Kyungjin, we are back. And this is Meant to be Eaten with Krishnendu Rae talking to Kyungjin Bae about her article, Taste as Governor, Soy Sauce in Late Joseon and Colonial Korea. And it's available in the latest issue of Gastronomica that I'm going to give details at the end of our conversation. So welcome back, Kyungjin.
Hi, again.
Hey, perfect. So we talked about the multiple and various kinds of sauces classified under what would eventually be seen as soy sauce. And we looked at the 18th century system of Meiju-based a double fermentation process that would be retrospectively come to be called the traditional Korean soy sauce. Now, in the article, you also talk about a next major transformation, which you identify first with the importation and then with the production of Japanese-style shoyu in Korea. First, when does that happen, and how does that process unfold?
Mm-hmm. So that is also very much an entangled history with this modern Korean history that started with the treaty made with Japan in the late 19th century and then the eventual Japanese occupation of Korea in the early 20th century. So in the second half of the 19th century, there were kind of springing sort of Japanese expat communities on the Korean peninsula. And then after 1910, when Korea was occupied, annexed, there were a large number of Japanese settlements on the Korean peninsula. So they start to bring, of course, Japanese breweries and Japanese kind of soy sauce to the Korean market. And in Japan, shoyu, obviously, there are various kinds of soy sauces in Japan as well, but shoyu was commodified from the earlier period, so 17th century at the latest, and they were largely urban and large company products that's based on wheat and soybeans and other ingredients. So that was a quite sort of cataclysmic changes on the Korean peninsula when the Japanese commodities, rather than, you know, brewed kind of sauces, were produced into produced in the Korean sort of Japanese enterprises and businesses. And rather than through home brewing mechanism, they were kind of introduced through the market. So these differing channels and differing products really had a lasting impact on the early 20th century Korean soy sauce.
I see. So at this point of time, are people using Korean style and Japanese style soy sauce differently with different foods?
You mean in the
early 20th century? Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yes. So it's not quite clear when Korean consumers start to use Japanese soy sauce, but it probably happened in a piecemeal fashion in the early 20th century. And certainly at the beginning of 20th century, that would have been a wealthy, you know, a well-to-do Korean sort of middle upper class families located in the Seoul and major cities where these breweries were located. And certainly after 1920s, more and more Korean consumers start to use or buy Japanese soy sauce for various reasons. So partially they were affordable. I mean, they could certainly buy that. But for other reasons, home brewing became increasingly difficult, especially in the 1930s and early 40s because of the wartime rationing. And, you know, it was a Pacific War. And before that, there was a Second Sino-Japanese War. So resources were becoming more scanty. And people were having trouble buying ingredients, so they had to rely on the market. And then at the same time at the market, there were more kind of cheap, chemically produced soy sauce available. So for various reasons, people were drawn to the market.
I see. So is there a... in a sense, are people talking about the difference in taste? Does the record show like people are discussing the taste of Japanese soy sauce and Korean soy sauce at this point of time?
Yes, certainly. Mm. So they were starting to kind of categorizing what had been perceived as, you know, various kind of soy sauces in Korea as this one umbrella term Korean soy sauce versus these imported or Korean brewed Japanese shoyu, which they kind of said as Japanese soy sauce. So those two groups were clearly different, not only in terms of their distribution mechanisms, but also in their tastes. So Korean soy sauce was considered sort of saltier, more nuttier or earthier, whereas the Japanese soy sauce sweeter and lighter.
I see.
Yes.
And so is there could you delve a little deeper into, was there a class difference emerging in terms of over time, in terms of consumption of the Japanese soyu and say the Korean one? And is there a cost difference or labor difference in production of these two products?
Yes. So the shoyu, certainly I'm not an expert in the Japanese soy sauce production, but scholars have said that it's a lot more labor intensive and it needs more capital because the initial stage of fermentation where you use scorched wheat and steamed soybean, and you also need kind of spores of koji, and you have to kind of mix together and kind of ferment it in a very delicate environment. So that is a very labor intensive and capital intensive.
And that's the Japanese style, right?
That's the Japanese style, right? So you need to have like a specialty in that rather than, you know, every kind of family can do it on your own.
I see.
Whereas in the case of Korean soy sauce fermentation, all you need is meju or soybeans, and you can make meju with it. And of course, brine, like salt and water. So every family's made their own soy sauce at home from the Joseon period onward.
Hey, what does this meju look like? Are there like visual material? Can you, is there something you can guess or you can see it very clearly?
Yes, so it's kind of a, it's sometimes it's cubical or oblong. It's like it's a lump of mashed sort of fermented soybeans, like in a brick shape oftentimes. And then they're kind of wrapped with this rice straw and or haze. And then it's kind of typical, stereotypical image of it is that in the winter, because it needs to be fermented and then dried, it's hanging in the eaves of a traditional traditional house. So when you visit your grandma, you know, you get to see this hanging meju in the eaves of their, like her house or something like that.
I see. And I think in your article, you have this beautiful visual material of like crock pots, right? In the backyard or something, like this huge field. For instance, how typical is this? That looks like it's, you need a lot of space to have all these jars of fermenting soy sauce. So there must have been a class difference. And how typical or atypical is producing your own soy sauce in your backyard?
So the scale is certainly an index of your wealth. And how many jars you can own has to do with, you know, how big your land is or, you know, how much kind of resources that you can muster to make soy sauce every year. I would say making soy sauce prior to the early 20th century was a standard household activity, actually mainstay of the household management in most of the families. But then how many can you make and what is the diversity of sauces that your family can have is probably an index of your wealth and, you know, social status. So a huge kind of clan family or, you know, the heads of the various branches of a lineage would have a huge estate full of these crock pots of filled with various aged soy sauces. So one thing about the soy sauce is that you don't necessarily consume like clearly the newly harvested and fermented soy sauce by the end of the year. A lot of people refill them with this next year's brewed soy sauce.
I see.
It kind of becomes more and more aged. And how old is that? you know, like your oldest soy sauce crock pot is, it's in some ways mark of your sort of social status.
I see. So that's kind of a link to both class and a kind of a taste. Hey, towards the end, we are slowly running out of time. So I want to draw your attention towards the end of your article. You say that in some ways, maybe the production, consumption, and connoisseurship of soy sauce in Korea could be described as an international rather than a national process. What do you mean by that?
Yes, that's a little bit of a bold statement. Yeah, so I was quite startled by how much of this colonial experience or colonial transformation in the soy sauce production and consumption had a profound impact on modeling post-colonial Korean palate. So because of this commercialization and hybridization of soy sauce production and consumption throughout the colonial periods, the contemporary, so late 20th and 21st century Koreans are basically consuming all different kinds of Japanese and Korean soy sauces at the same time. Different kinds of recipes or different kinds of dishes developed in tandem with this diversification of sauces. So for example, shoyu, or what Koreans call waeganjang, which is kind of Japanese soy sauce, goes better with like stir fries or marinated like casseroles and things, foods like that. And traditional Korean style soy sauce are used in soup making or kind of seasoning lightly blanched vegetables. So those sort of different recipes call for different soy sauces. And part of it, you know, definitely came from the colonial experience.
I see. Excellent. This is kind of fascinating. Sorry, we have run out of time. But thank you, Kyungjing, for giving us such a beautiful talk. And so this is really exciting work. And listeners can read the full article in Gastronomica Volume 20, Issue 4, which is due out this month, which is November 2020. And for more details, you can visit gastronomica.org. So thank you, Kyungjing.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
So join us next week as we talk to Amy Bentley and Stephanie Borkowski about their online archive, which maps how the COVID-19 pandemic has impacted New York's city food system. Thank you. This is Krishnendu Rai.
Meant to be Eaten is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to learn more about our 10-year anniversary celebration happening all year long, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.